Okay, good. So here's the last class that we're going to have. And it's on morality, and it is only the most general of all general overviews. Morality is probably the most nuanced, multifaceted topic that anybody can possibly take up. And it's probably possible that I raise more questions here than I'll settle. But what I'd like to do is at least have a breakthrough in helping you to understand why we think the way we think as the church. So back in high school, personally, I had a huge breakthrough at the age of 16 in a religion class, which finally made it clear to me why the church teaches what it teaches. Once that breakthrough happened, everything else about the faith quickly fell into place. All kinds of things that I thought were doubts weren't really doubts. All kinds of things that I thought were disagreements weren't really disagreements. So much fell into place once I realized, that's what I'm trying to share with you, is that experience of understanding why we think the way we think. So that's only the most general of overviews, okay? So here we go. We begin the understanding of moral rights and wrongs by considering that a human being has a design and a purpose. Okay? It's somewhat analogous to a car that has a design and a purpose. If you want the car to run well, you follow the owner's manual. You get the oil change every 3,000 miles, and it hums. It just does exactly as it was meant to do. You could think of it as a design and a purpose, like a light bulb. I think I've used this image before. A light bulb, it has a design and a purpose. It's meant to be plugged into a socket, and it glows. It makes a great light bulb if it's treated like a light bulb, but it makes a lousy bookend or a lousy hammer. It's not designed to do that. It's not treated in accordance with its nature. But see, people don't often stop to think that a human being has a design. Because we have a designer. And we have a purpose. Because God has given us a purpose. I'll jump right to the conclusion. Your purpose is to know the truth and to love. And that brings you into relationship with God and others. That's your purpose. Okay? And all morality ultimately is ordered towards this purpose. What we happen to discover is that we flourish as human beings when we act in accordance with what we were designed to act in accordance with. And we find that we're really unhappy when we don't. And it's a long, long process of overcoming ego and selfishness and a desire for instant gratification to bring us to the point where we care more about what's right than what we want and about what's true and good for others than what's in our immediate interest. This is the process of becoming a saint, but morality is what tells us what the rights are and what the wrongs are and why we should try to choose them, okay? So, like I said, it requires discipline, it requires sacrifice. Over the long haul, this is what leads to happiness, okay? Now, you might have an understanding of morality in the church as being, what's the public perception of morality in the church? There's a guy over in Rome, far, far away, maybe up in a podium somewhere, great big hat, and he's got a great big book, and he's saying, no, 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 and don't, right? Somebody once said, the summary of all Catholic theology is the word no. Right? But that's a misunderstanding. That misunderstanding was partly addressed in the Second Vatican Council because, well, it's a long, long story, but basically, historical realities being what they were, we came to regard moral theology as something that derived simply from God willing it. We call this voluntarism. So I could maybe even stump you right here. We take the Ten Commandments. Take one of the Ten Commandments. We say one of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not steal. Could God take that commandment away? Could God change that commandment? Could God say, thou shalt steal? Let's just try to imagine it. Could stealing become right if God said it was right? The answer is no. But you have to understand moral theology to understand why. Okay? God would never make such a change because such a change is not in his nature or in the nature or in the order of reality. But if you don't have an understanding of this, you can begin to think that right and wrong come simply because the priest said so, or the church said so, or mom said so. That's voluntarism, okay? And if you've got a really great and holy guide, you can be told right and true things, simply on the argument from authority. But there's a problem with the human person that hears the argument from authority. We still want to do what we want to do. So as soon as we hear this is right and this is wrong because the church said so and doesn't go any further than that, I start to turn the church's moral teachings into merely laws. This is legalism. Okay? I must keep the law. Here's a law. Don't eat meat on Fridays in Lent. Legalism. Here's the problem with legalism. It doesn't do anything to address the fact that the will of the person who's given the law still has this wayward will and it's headed in the wrong direction. It's not identified with the whole of his faith or his well-being. So as soon as you hear a law, you start to ask, well, what's the least I have to do? Does chicken count as meat? I get this question a lot. The answer is yes, it does. But, you know, these people are like, well, you know, can I cook with chicken broth and make a soup? And the question, you see, the problem is once you start realizing something's a law, you start to minimize it, and you want to live a minimalistic understanding of it. And you see how the Christian life then gets reduced to following laws as little as you possibly can follow them and doing as much of what you want as you possibly can do. That's a really diminished and weakened understanding of why we teach what we teach. That's what the Second Vatican Council, one of the things I tried to address. Okay, it's one of the things I tried to address. Like, for example, I would never take you to the zoo and take you to the cage of the Bengal tiger. And you know, if you said, how far can I reach my arm into the cage before it becomes dangerous? I'd say, stop it. You don't even want to be asking that question. The entire thing is bad. Because you understand the importance of health. You understand the importance of having your arm in one piece. And you don't even want to risk that. But the church tried to expand our understanding of moral theology to something beyond merely rule keeping, and to try to emphasize that what we teach is actually for our well being and for the well being of everybody else. I've got a little historical note in here for you as well. There was a divide in moral thinking in which Renaissance humanists, people like Descartes, people like Voltaire. You remember from your high school philosophy classes. Humanists, even the name humanism, said, you know what, the whole purpose of man's fulfillment is in this world alone. We don't need God. We don't need God at all. And in fact, this is the roots of relativism that we see in our world today. Pretty much every moral problem that we see in our world today comes from this idea that we can be fulfilled in this world without God. Okay. And that was one of the consequences of this divide in moral thinking. Another consequence was Protestant reformers overemphasized the depravity of mankind, said earthly life has no value whatsoever. What we need to do is endure through this world and make it to heaven. And that's not right either. This is a very, very good world. Things are very, very good here, although fallen, although flawed. So secularists said fulfillment is in this world alone. Fundamentalists said, fulfillment is in heaven, earth be damned. Okay? The church takes neither of these positions. Doing God's will is not a choice between earth or heaven. I could say the way to heaven is heavenly, and the way to hell is hellish. That's not to say that the way to hell can't be a heck of a lot of fun. Okay? But ultimately, the one who chooses sin has a deep, deep unhappiness and a deep self-loathing. And the one who chooses virtue may struggle and suffer, but they're deeply happy inside. Did I ever tell you the story of St. John of the Cross? Did I say that last week?
Yes.
St. John of the Cross? Anyway,
okay.
I mentioned it. I'll just repeat it real briefly. John of the Cross was imprisoned in Toledo in this terrible... I think I mentioned this. Yeah, I talked about the size of the table. The size of his cell was like the size of this table. And he finds himself imprisoned and has no doors, nothing like that. And he's incredibly happy. And he writes about this. And he realizes his happiness has nothing to do with his circumstances. His happiness has everything to do with his relationship with the Lord. That's what the church wants for us. And it's actually is an actual consequence of choosing what's right. So God's will isn't arbitrary. What actually leads to our good is called good. What leads to our destruction and our unhappiness is called evil. It doesn't mean that you're not going to suffer en route to choosing a good thing. Because you know, many, many people do. But I'm telling you, the martyr on the way up to the gallows to have his head lopped off is happier in his soul than the reveler who's drunk and doesn't know what day of the week it is. This is the idea of, they call this the eudaimonistic approach to theology. That's what I'm trying to share with you. Eudaimonia, it's a Greek word for well-being. Okay, so here's the thing. We're talking about moral theology. God created you with two faculties. He gave you an intellect and he gave you a free will. Right? Moral theology is the study of how we're meant to find our happiness in this life and our eternal happiness in the next using that intellect and using that free will. Okay? Following the plan God has established for us. Here's what separates you from the animals. Here's what separates you from a turnip. Here's what separates you from a daisy. You have a mind. And your mind can know the truth. And you have a will and it can choose to love. That doesn't mean that a dog doesn't have a mind. But a dog doesn't sit and try to discern the truth. He just tries to discern where his next meal is coming from. Did I ever tell you about this psychological study with the ape? No? Very interesting. There's a very, very intelligent ape and actually taught this ape how to communicate with sign language. The ape spent all of its time asking for a banana. The only thing it learned how to say was, you, banana, you, me, give. That's what he said over and over. The ape never asked a question. The ape never said, how are you? Why am I in a cage? There was never inquiry. You see what I mean? There was stimulus, response, needs, fulfillment. This is the cognition at the level of an animal. You've got more than that. You can seek and know the truth. And then there's will. Animal can certainly display something like affection, but you know, we wouldn't call it love like a human being is called love or like God calls us to love. So anyway, your intellect, your free will, the fulfillment of your intellect is knowing the truth. The fulfillment of your will is in loving. Okay, that's what we're seeking after. So we talk about right and wrong and how we know what's right and wrong. There's two sources, reason and revelation. And both of them are important. Okay, reason basically means natural law. And I'll tell you, I'm going over, painting in broad strokes here, but I hope this kind of makes sense. Natural law is the following. It's the understanding that things flourish when treated in accordance with their nature. Right? So, if I want a plant to flourish, I have to treat it like a plant. I have to put it in a pot of soil. I have to make sure it's properly watered, has proper light, has proper fertilizing. I once had a plant in seminary. I left it over the summer. The thing was still alive. No water, no light. Left in a corner. So the other seminarians and I, is this plant immortal? Can this plant be killed? We started feeding the plant Coca-Cola just to see what would happen. The thing never died. It was incredible. But you know, ordinarily, if you take a plant and you put it in a pot full of cherry-flavored Pez and stick it in a closet, it's not going to grow. Okay, it has to be treated in accordance with its nature. And a human being is just the same. It has to be treated in accordance with his nature. That's reason. So by reason, you can know thou shalt not steal. It's bad for everybody. By reason, you should know thou shalt not commit adultery. It's bad for everybody. But reason isn't enough. We also have divine revelation. We talked about it in a previous class. Reason can help you to avoid lots of things, but it can't tell you about your divine destiny. This is very, very important to understand. Your destiny as a child of God to be who finds happiness and fulfillment in God alone. So reason would never tell you love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who mistreat you and be good to those who persecute you. You need divine revelation for that. Okay. Reason would never tell you that your ultimate motive is the knowledge and the love of God. You need divine revelation for that. But those things are really important for the flourishing of the human person. Okay, so far so good? Okay. Reason and divine revelation. Okay. This is where we get our rights and wrongs. Now, using your intellect and then choosing with your will, this is where moral good and moral evil come from. Allow me to differentiate between moral evil and non-moral evil. Non-moral evil is like a hurricane. It's bad, but nobody chose it. Okay? Moral evil are all the things that a human being, all the things that we can bring upon ourselves by our bad use of our free will. And moral good are the good things that come about as a consequence of the good use of our free will. Moral good and moral evil start in your will, okay? And that begins in your mind. Another principle, your free choice is self-determinative. You actually become what you choose at the level of your being. Okay, so consider, if you steal, let's just say steal, it makes it nice and easy, if you steal, something of who you are at the level of your soul is diminished. You become a bit more corrupted, less than God intended you to be, less than you're supposed to be for everybody else. And if you continue along that path, not only will you become less and less and less and less of a human being, but you actually become in your actions what you've chosen to be, a thief. You can rightly be called one. It describes you. Same thing holds true for telling lies. You're diminished as a human being, your soul is somewhat more vacant, and you become what you've chosen to be, a liar. Similarly, the same thing holds true for good actions. People can be honest, integral, reliable, trustworthy, sacrificial. It's not just a quality that stands on the outside of you as like a garment that you're wearing. It's who you are. It's actually self-determinative. You actually become what you choose. Okay? People say, can you change? Can you change? Yes, you can change. But you do carry the residue of all your past actions and the disposition to repeat them. Okay? So think of it as like somebody who has eaten McDonald's and nothing but McDonald's. They can get healthy again, but it's going to be hard. It's going to be a lot easier if you've had some salads, okay? A lot easier. And the same thing with moral truth and moral goodness and moral evil. If you do wrong things, it makes it harder to do right things. And if you do right things, it makes it harder to do wrong things. Here's an example that I like to use. If there's a $100 bill sitting on this table, and you walk into this room, you see that $100 bill, you're not tempted to keep it. You're thinking, whoa, somebody left a $100 bill sitting out. I better turn this into the office. I better find the priest. Somebody's missing $100. I like to think that you're not even tempted to keep it. Doesn't faze you in the slightest. There could be somebody else, though. They see that exact same $100 bill. They really struggle with the decision not to keep that money for their own and to tell no one. They really struggle. They sweat bullets. Question. Of the two of them, who has more merit before God? The one who immediately turns it over and doesn't think twice about it, or the one who turns it over to the authorities, but only first after really going through a hard, hard struggle? Who has more merit before God?
Who struggles.
The one who really struggles? The answer is the first one. And the reason is because he has become that way by a lifetime of making the right decision. It would be like saying, which athlete is more fit? The one who runs a 100-yard dash and doesn't even raise his blood pressure, or the one who runs a 100-yard dash panting, gasping, and barely alive? The one who's more fit is the one who doesn't have to think twice about it. It's come natural to him. Morally speaking, it's the same way. You become what you choose. Make sense? And every action you take carries with it all the past residue of all those past actions. We want that, right? You can always turn it around, but I'm saying it's cumulative. It adds up. You are at this moment the sum total of everything you've ever chosen. Not everything that's ever happened to you, but everything you've ever chosen, okay? So this is, we create virtues and vices. As I've tried to say before, virtues are the residue of previous good actions and the disposition to repeat them. Vices are the residue of previous bad actions and the disposition to repeat them. Think of them as habits. A virtue is a habit. A vice is a habit. You can get into good habits, you can get into bad habits, but it begins by what you choose. Okay? It begins by what you choose, getting back to that moral choice being self-determinative. We take all these things together, we call them your character, the sum total of your virtue and your vice. Okay. So that's another big idea. Virtues, vices, intellect, free will, the sources of morality. Let's talk about conscience now. Here's a big, big moral category, conscience. People think of conscience as the ultimate subjective moral hiding place. As if to say, my conscience told me it was okay, therefore, it was okay, regardless of what it was. That's actually a misunderstanding of conscience. Okay? Conscience is a choice. It's not a feeling. It's a judgment. You can act in accordance with it or you can act against it. But basically, conscience is you take all your knowledge of what's good and what's evil and you make a practical decision. This is right. I will do it. This is wrong. I will not do it. Or this is right. I will not do it. This is wrong. I will not do it. Conscience is that decision. I think a lot of people like to fool themselves and think, well, you know, it's like my feeling inside, but it really isn't. Conscience is that voice inside you that detects what's true and then decides whether or not to act on it. Truth be told, all of us are violating our consciences all the time. You got a voice inside of you that says, you know what's right, but damn it, you don't care. You want what you want. That's what's happening all the time. And your conscience is that knowledge. It won't go away. You can tell it to shut up. Eventually it will shut up. Eventually it will diminish and diminish and diminish. And it will become almost unnoticeable. But that knowledge somewhere deep down inside that there is a right and there is a wrong and I'm acting in accordance with it or I'm not acting, that's what your conscience is. Okay, that's what your conscience is. So I would say conscience doesn't invent what's true. Conscience recognizes what's true. Conscience doesn't decide for itself what's true. Conscience recognizes what's true. So please don't understand, it's not a subjective individual judgment about what I think is right or wrong. Now, here's the thing about conscience, though. Your conscience can be good or it can be bad based on whether it's based on what's really true. So I can have a completely erroneous idea of what's right and what's wrong. It's not in accord with what really is right and really wrong. You could talk about, let's just make up an example. I was in Italy outside of the Milan Cathedral, and a couple of gypsy children tried to carry out a pickpocket attack on me with newspapers. They mumble in some foreign language. One of them smashes the newspapers in front of you right up against your face while the other one rifles through your pockets. They've probably been doing this they're probably 6 years old. They've probably been doing this their entire conscious lives. They might not think that it's wrong, but is it still wrong?
Yeah,
sure it is.
It is.
Their conscience might not be well formed. You have to form it in accordance with what's true. You have a responsibility to seek out what's true when you don't know. Here's another example of that. The classic example of the bear hunter in the woods with the gun. He hears a rustling in the bushes. Is it a bear or is it a fellow hunter? What should he do? Try to find out whether it's another bear or whether it's a fellow hunter. Okay? He shouldn't just shoot. He should make an... And if he does, he's actually acted morally irresponsibly. So conscience has a responsibility to try to learn what's right and wrong. All your life long, you're being given the opportunity. And, you know, here you are, you're in my little class, you're doing great, okay? But keep learning. When you have a doubt of conscience, especially when you hear about a teaching of the church, you talk about homosexuality, you talk about contraception, all these hot-button topics. You say, I don't agree with the church on that. You know what? Stop. Learn. Listen. Find a reputable source. Listen to a tape. You're going to be surprised to discover that it makes an incredible amount of sense. Might require sacrifice. Might not make you popular. Might be hard for people to understand. But, man, does it make clear sense. It's always ordered towards that. In conscience, you should know your obligation to form your conscience. Okay? Because after a while... either you act according to what you believe or you believe according to what you act. You know, you end up deciding whether or not to act on the truth and to inform yourself. And I'm here to tell you conscience decisions can be bad, and if you don't make the effort to inform your conscience, you can incur guilt for that. You're supposed to learn, and you're supposed to try to reconcile your doubts of conscience, okay? Basically here I'm talking about forming your conscience. For Catholics, the most important thing is the teaching of the Church, because we understand this is founded by Christ, guided by the Holy Spirit. Okay? The moral teachings of the Church specify morality. It talks about what the natural law and divine revelation from Christ as it applies in some specific act or circumstance. People will say, Jesus didn't say anything about assault weapons. Well, it doesn't mean that there's not a moral right or a moral wrong. Okay? You can learn, you can apply in the Church. When teaching, and this is part of what we get back to when we talk about the Church, it doesn't teach us moral wrongs. People in it might do moral wrongs. It might keep its mouth shut. It might not speak out. But it's not going to say that something is right when it actually is wrong. The Church isn't going to mislead us on that. That's why we want to study it. We want to be guided by it. That's why we listen. It's not really one opinion among many. This is very, very important. The teachings of the Church are specifications of natural law and divine revelation as it applies to a particular situation, particular circumstance. This is what leads to our good. This is what leads to our happiness. This is what we want to listen to. Okay? So here's your basic, basic broad view overarching approach of how we look at morality. There's a connection between God's plan and the fulfillment of you as a human being and your human nature. Human nature never changes. If human nature changes, human beings would no longer be human beings. They'd be something else. Okay? What's morally right and wrong, that doesn't change either. I mean, wrong for me is wrong for somebody else. And those are the basic principles. What's morally good leads to fulfillment. What's morally evil damages it. Okay, that's a broad overview, at least how we're approaching this subject. Now, you could start to apply it to many different things and raise many different questions. Moral theology is a very, very long, complicated subject, but that's at least the overarching understanding. Okay, let's take a couple more out. We'll take a couple more little things we're going to take here. We talk about what makes something morally good or bad. I got two, three things listed here: object, end, and circumstance. Let's talk about these. The object is the thing that you're doing, and the end is the reason that you're doing it. A really important idea in morality is that the reason that you're doing something doesn't make a wrong thing right. Committing adultery because I feel like I'm so in love, it does make a wrong thing right. The action of committing adultery, that's a bad thing. No subjective reason for that can change the nature of it. Okay. Also, doing things for a bad reason. I'm going to hold a fundraiser for a local poorhouse, but I'm doing it so that everyone will applaud me as being such a great guy. It's a bad reason. And clearly, once that reason becomes known, people realize that I'm a facade, I'm a fraud. So those are two things. What you do has to be a good thing. Okay? And it doesn't become right just because of your reason. In other words, ends don't justify the means. And if ends justify the means, you can find yourself in some real moral conundrums. You can find yourself justifying almost anything. And the only way out of that is to recognize, you know what, certain things, no matter what your reason is, the action itself, it's always disordered. Okay, but that's not the only thing. There's also circumstances. The most important thing to understand about circumstances surrounding an action is that circumstances don't make right actions wrong and wrong actions right. What they do, rather, is they change the praiseworthiness or the blameworthiness of what you're doing. So, you talk about, let's make up the hypothetical situation. Sometimes this comes up in moral theology circles. The Nazi who says to the woman, "You got to sleep with me or I'm going to shoot your father." It doesn't become right for her to sleep with the guy just because he's making a threat. However, the circumstances sure do mitigate her responsibility if she does sleep with the guy. Does it become right? It does not become right. Does it become less blameworthy? It sure does. Make sense? The simplest way to understand circumstances, let's just talk about stealing, let's just talk about money. If I steal $5, is that wrong? Yes. If I steal $5,000, is that wrong?
Yes.
Is it worse? Is stealing $5,000 worse than five? Actually, it is. It's more morally blameworthy because it's more money. Okay. And you'll find this in confession, for example, in which I say, if you went to my confession class, and I hope you were there for my confession class, you remember, if you committed a mortal sin, you confess a mortal sin, if you committed it five times, you should say that I committed it five times because it matters. Okay? Circumstances don't, but often people think, well, if the circumstances are bad enough, you know, if I was tired enough or if I was hungry enough, it makes it okay that I committed the crime. It actually doesn't make it okay that you committed the crime. What it does is it makes it a heck of a lot less blameworthy, okay? Or more praiseworthy, depending on the circumstance might be. But please don't understand circumstances changing the nature of an action, or you're going to end yourself, you're going to lose all anchoring in rights and wrongs, and it'll end up being subjective, it'll end up being based on what you feel like, and that's basically where we are today. That's kind of what gets the world in the mess that it's in. Everybody's doing what's right and wrong because of what they feel like it doing, okay? So object, what you do, end, why you do it, they both have to be good. If either one of them is bad, you've got a problem. Circumstances, they can sure adjust the blameworthiness or the praiseworthiness of an action, but they can't change it. Okay, and the last category to consider here, moral cooperation. This comes up all the time. So here's an example. Abortion's wrong, and you shouldn't promote it or encourage it or in any way support it. But let's pretend like you work in a hospital that does abortions. Do you have to quit your job?
No.
It depends. Okay, it depends. If you're working in a hospital that performs abortions, we say that in some degree, because you're part of this institution, you are a cooperator in something that's morally evil. Okay? But not all cooperation is created equally. I've got this difference here, material cooperation and formal cooperation. Here's a clearer example. If I'm working in the hospital where they're performing abortions, and I'm actively referring people to the abortionist so that they can get abortions, that would be formal cooperation. I'm assisting in the immorality, and I agree with what's happening. You can't do that. That's always wrong. You're not actually performing the abortion, but you sure are making it possible, and you agree with it. You think it's something everyone should have more of. I hope that's really clear that you can't, you know, for example, you might not have robbed the bank, but you sure as heck drove the getaway car, and you are going to get a share of the loot as well. You didn't rob the bank, but that doesn't get you off the hook. No court of law would exonerate you for that. You're a cooperator, and you're a formal cooperator because you actually agree with the wrong thing that's being done. That's not very interesting. We already agree on that. The interesting thing is material cooperation. The interesting thing is really, you work in the hospital, do you have to quit your job because the hospital does abortions? Well, and I said the answer is it depends. It depends on how close you are to the wrong being done. To put it simply, there's two ways you can be a material cooperator. Everybody with me so far on the terms? Let's just clarify the term real quick. Material cooperator is that you're part of the moral action that's being, the immoral action that's being done, but you don't agree with it. Okay? You don't agree with it. The question becomes, how close are you to the wrong being done? That's what makes it right or wrong. Basically, if your participation is essential to the action taking place, it doesn't matter whether you agree with it or not, you can't do it. If your participation is so far away that it would happen whether or not the evil would happen whether or not you were there, you're far enough away from it that it's not really morally blameworthy on your part. Okay, so you might hate abortion, but if you're the nurse in the room where it's happening, you're handing the surgeon the instruments. I'm sorry, but you're essential. You can't do that, even regardless of what you think in your heart. If you are a taxi cab driver, I think you'd have lots of instances of this. Suppose you're a taxi cab driver and you're sitting outside the First National Bank of Fredericksburg and you hear gunshots fired and masked men come out carrying great big bags that have dollar signs written on them. And they jump into your cab And they say, quick, take me anywhere, anywhere. You would be a material cooperator because you didn't rob the bank. You didn't have anything to do with robbing the bank, but you're playing an essential role in helping them get away with the crime. If it wasn't for you, they couldn't do it. So I call that proximate material cooperation or immediate material cooperation or remote material cooperation.
Even if they had guns pointed at
them? Well, now see how complicated moral theology can get? I'm actually just trying to isolate these things one at a time. The question you just asked would take me a long time to quantify terms. It would just be too time consuming. Let's pretend like they didn't have guns. Let's pretend like they put their guns away just to make life simple. Okay? Because again, there are so many categories of moral theology that I can talk about. There are certain circumstances in which you don't even have a good decision to make. This is the famous example of the Nazi who knocks on the door and says, "Are you hiding any Jews in your basement?" Well, you've got two choices. You can turn over innocent people or you can lie. Those are your only choices. What do? You choose the lesser of the two. Is it still wrong to lie? Yes. Is that the best thing you could do in that situation? Yes. You see what I mean? But sometimes people will twist themselves into such a pretzel that they'll try to say that it isn't a lie. It is a lie. But it's the best thing. The moral theology can be very complicated. So remote is when you're so far away from it, you know, you're just mopping the floor and somebody else in the hospital, they're doing the abortions. Immediate, it couldn't happen without you. Okay? You can't have immediate material cooperation. Okay? If it couldn't happen without you, you have to, in conscience, stand up and say, "I can't do this." And that's happened to all of us at different times in our lives, where someone has put in a position where we're instrumental in carrying out something wrong. And we've had to say, "You know what? I can't do it. I can't drive the car. I can't lend you the money," whatever it might be. Okay. So that's cooperation, real briefly, very, very briefly. Now, your next two pages, I'm not really going to try to get through it because it's just too much. Medical morality. What I've done here is I've given you an outline of some basic medical moral principles. Any of these could be the subject of an hour-long talk. But I decided I'd include them, even though I knew I wouldn't have time to get through them all, just for your own reference, just for your own reference sake. Okay? So there's a quickie short look at morality, and we've got a few minutes left over for questions if anybody wants to ask.